I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Committee to order. Do we have a quorum?
Yeah, it's okay.
And we have a quorum. And everybody needs to be introduced. This is Sloane Lavender West. She is 1 month old, and she thinks government is too bright, and she would like to go back to sleep. So she got to come to a bill hearing, and she's just the cutest thing you've ever seen in your life, except for maybe her older sister. So she just had to make an appearance. And now we'll get down to business. Yes. And true champion of my wife, Megan, who also testified before the committee, health committee, and delivered the child, which I wasn't going to make her bring both, even though I desperately wanted to. All right. Do I have a motion on the minutes of February 25th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Hansen moves the minutes from February 25th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Now on to the agenda. We have House File 1346. So I will move House File 1346 before the committee to be re-referred to the Human Services Committee. Representative Nash, feel free to introduce your wonderful bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Jim Nash. For those of you that have been on the committee or have been incumbents, and I don't see any new members, you know that I've been working on this issue for a number of years, and some of you know my history, but I'll state it again for posterity and for those watching online. I grew up as an abused kid, and for 17 years of my life, my dad beat the crap out of me, and I suffered through a lot of things. As a corollary to that, my abuser passed away last Thursday, so there's now a little bit of closure where there wasn't previously. So that's both messy and good at the same time, but it makes it easier to publish the book that I'm working on. So, but 1346 is a bill that has been underway for a little while in working with some of the advocates that are in and around this issue. And it's really to elevate and try to standardize some of the training that goes on for mandatory reporters. It is something that everybody knows that mandatory reporters play a critical role. And you may remember that the most important person in my life who was a mandatory reporter, my mom, failed and didn't turn my abuser in. But this bill seeks to bring a higher level of detail to the training, provide a greater level of standardization. There will be other bills that I work on after the fact as well to really kind of remove a patchwork of training as it relates to mandatory reporters across the state of Minnesota. But this is a personal issue for me, but I also know that there's a great many kids in the state of Minnesota that are watching the legislature and are saying, I really need some champions. So I hope that you all will join me in being a champion for the kids around our state that need somebody to stand up for them. And I will thank the department because this language was really sort of, we met in a couple of times and we had conversations and we were very frank about some of the needs that are present. So this is really an output of that work. And Mr. Chair, there are some testifiers, so if we can just move right along to them. I don't want to belabor your committee, but we do have some testifiers, so we can bring them forward at the time.
Thank you, Representative Nash.
Apparently we're having technology issues.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
We are having
I can sing show tunes if necessary to fill the time.
We are going to soldier right along. If I would ask Chair Katisbatoon, Vice Chair Hansen, are we okay to soldier along or would you like us to wait? Okay. And this is why I hate Zoom. All right. We will pass the high chews around. Anybody prefer Hershey Kisses? Okay. Hey, we had training on that, Representative McDonald. Well, I'll recess the committee. Sorry about that, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to head across the hall really quick to see where I am progressionally in that list. I do have a bill up in the other committee. I just want to make sure.
We're good now? Okay.
Well, I just have to stick my head in to see where they are. I think I'm last on their agenda. I just wanted to confirm that. Thank you.
I'm assuming it. Well, she could watch on YouTube and then voice them. I just don't want to be accused of blocking debate.
That's soothing.
Alarm should be muted. This one needs to be on. No, it's fine.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want me to start the whole thing all over again?
I think we should be good.
Yeah, I can.
Okay, now it's working.
Call this meeting back to order. Representative Nash, I apologize for that delay. Please, now we're on public testimony. That's where we're
Mr. Chair, would you let me go back and do the introduction of the bill so that all people watching on Zoom can benefit from the dulcet tones of Jim Nash, or should we just move along? All right, well, so members, Jim Nash, District 48A, House File 1346 is, as I had said previously for those in the room, that it's really an effort that I have been undertaking since last year, where I shared with a lot of you that were here in the committee or on the floor that as a kid who grew up as an abused child, this has become very, very important for me. I had shared to those in the committee that my abuser died last Thursday, and while people struggle to rush to apologize, saying sorry. I don't know that that's something that I need right now. But the reality is, we have a lot of kids in the state of Minnesota who need a well-trained mandatory reporter, and 1346 seeks to do just that. It's to create a standardized and greater detailed training that will help people become a better mandatory reporter. The gist of the bill is really in subdivision 2 and forward. It is not an onerous amount of new information, but I think what will happen is it's going to get mandatory reporters better trained to identify what does abuse look like and how do we stop it. For those of us that have grown up as abused, we know what it looks like. And as I had said earlier, I would ask that you join me in being a champion for the kids that need somebody who will stand up for them, because as simple as it sounds, it's apparently not that simple. Because as I had shared before we recessed and came back, and this is for the benefit of the people online, the person that I relied on to be my mandatory reporter, which was my mom, who was a director of nursing, failed miserably and did not report my father's abuse. We can fix that. We should all join together, whether we're Republican or Democrat. The kids in our district need a champion. So I would ask that you join me in doing that. And Mr. Chair, as I'd said, I have a testifier, Melissa DeBilzen, if she would come up to the the testifier's table. She's going to provide some brief oversight. Mr. Chair, is there somebody online to testify as well, or is it?
Is there somebody online to testify?
No. Just Spencer Marsh.
Not that we are aware of.
Okay. Thank you,
Representative
Mr.
Nash. Ms. DeBilzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa DeBilzen, and I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, a nonprofit advocating for the safety and well-being of children at risk of maltreatment. We work closely with a number of frontline professionals in the child welfare system. Child abuse is a significant but often overlooked issue in Minnesota. We see this in state data, but it is rarely discussed publicly. In 2022, around 5,000 children were confirmed victims of abuse, and tragically, 21 children lost their lives. If this were a childhood disease, we would be pouring money into treatments and cures. Like a disease, we know that prevention is key, and there are better outcomes for kids when abuse and neglect are detected and mitigated early on. This is where mandated reporters come in. Mandated reporters play a critical role. These teachers, child care providers, healthcare workers, law enforcement, and social services professionals are often a child's first line of defense. Nearly 80,000 reports of potential maltreatment were made across Minnesota counties in 2022, and 80% of them originated from mandated reporters. Robust training for mandated reporters is essential. However, after reviewing the state's mandated reporter training, we were shocked by what was and wasn't being taught. Of the 45-minute training, only 2 to 3 minutes were dedicated to recognizing signs of maltreatment. Additionally, the training misrepresented child protection as potentially harmful to families and included guidance that contradicted state law, such as requiring reporters to be certain of maltreatment rather than having reason to believe. Fortunately, the Child Welfare Training Academy has been open to feedback. To build on their openness to continuous improvement, we strongly support Representative Nash's bill, which ensures training meets two basic requirements. First, at least half the training must focus on recognizing signs of maltreatment. This is important because daycare workers may not realize that any bruises on infants under 4 months old are suspicious. A preschool teacher might not know that bruises on the neck are rare and concerning. A school secretary seeing a child regularly arrive hungry may not know if it's poverty or statutory neglect. A few minutes of training simply is not enough. Signs of maltreatment must be incorporated into mandated reporter training, not treated as an afterthought. Second, training must be informed by professionals with expertise in child maltreatment. A child abuse pediatrician, for example, is best suited to educate on physical signs of abuse. An attorney ensures legal accuracy. A mental health professional can advise on sensitive questioning. And a social worker can provide insight on available resources. This is a simple, common sense bill that can have a profound impact on protecting Minnesota's children. I urge your support to ensure mandated reporters receive comprehensive, expert-informed training to help keep children safe. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I am open to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. DeBilzen. Representative Nash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I would be remiss if I didn't say a thank you to my friend, Representative Moeller, who is my number two and helped me get the stuff done last year as well. And she has been a great champion of this. I thought I was past this part, but apparently it wasn't. This is really a bipartisan effort. So stakes are too high to not get this right. So again, I appreciate your assistance in this. Stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony and move on to member questions. Member questions. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill and for always just being such a champion. I really appreciate it. And I do just have a question because I don't understand why it was done this way. Not a problem, just a question. where it says suspected maltreatment, and then it crossed off suspected abuse as defined as the statute. I guess I thought we would still be doing training on suspected abuse. It wouldn't just be maltreatment, or did I misunderstand?
Mr. Chair, it would be suspected maltreatment, so it would be suspected abuse and neglect would be the training that would be covered.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Representative Hicks.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make sure we weren't just going to focus on maltreatment, and we would still talk about the bruises on the neck and the, you know, the abuse piece. Okay. That wasn't clear to me, and I appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative?
And Representative, you know that I'm never going to delete things that we need to be looking for. So in consultation with nonpartisan staff who helped us draft this, that was one of the strikeouts to expand and make sure that we're getting everything that we need to get. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Katiza Batun.
Thank you, Chair West. And thank you, Chair Nash, for being here and for sharing your story. And I know it takes a lot of courage to publicly go through the things that you've experienced. And there are so many of us at the table who have been on the other end, right, supporting kids who have already been through it. And I think it really makes a big difference when we have voices like yours at the table, when we have voices like Representative Hansen, who has shared some of her story at the table, and we all get to make better policy because of your experience. And I'm grateful for that and for you bringing this forward.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Batun. One last thing I want to say about this bill, as I'm in co-author on it, when I met with Safe Passage and they explained the bill, it was just like, oh man, this needs to happen. And in many cases, in the Small World Learning Center in Blaine, you have many suspect cases of difficulties with mandated reporter people not even knowing. Mandated reporters with their own children not even knowing they should report to the proper authorities and not just to their superior. There's a lot of confusion there, so improving this training is incredibly important. All right, and before we close it, before your closing comments, Chair Katiza Batun.
Sorry for that. I'm hoping perhaps your testifier could give us a little bit of clarity on currently who is required to go through the mandatory reporter training, and does that change? Does it get expanded at all if this moves forward, or is just the content of the training for those people who are already required? Sorry for the delay.
Ms. DeBills.
Mr. Chair, it is open and available to all mandated reporters in Minnesota. I don't know the answer if they are required at this point. Someone from DCYF may know that answer. I don't know if they're required to take the training or not. I think some programs and in some, it depends on the organization, but.
This is why we have geniuses to my right. Ms. Sunderman, can you enlighten us?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. This section does not require mandated reporters to complete or undergo training. It requires training to be offered to mandated reporters. And like the testifier said, it is typically left up to the individual organization whether or not to require their employees who are mandated reporters to do a training.
Chair, please do what you
have. Thank you, Chair West. And I appreciate just that little bit of extra clarity. Obviously, step number one is making sure that the training covers what we needed to train or to cover. And then perhaps we talk down the line about making sure that folks are required to actually access that information. Thank you.
Representative Nash, to close us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Katiza Batun, I think we just found our next bill. I'm watching the eyes as we're panning through. It's like, oh, wait. Everybody should be required to take this training. So maybe we can get that jacketed up right away and get that moving because, I'm grateful for the time. I'm grateful for I know that you're with me on this. So I look forward. I'm sure some of you all will be at the next committee stop, but this is a big deal. And we have the ability as lawmakers to put a lot of the partisan differences that we may have aside to coalesce around the right issue. And this is one of those right issues. So I appreciate your support, Mr. Chair, and look forward to working with everybody along the way to get this passed.
And this is indeed the committee for that. So I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 1346 to the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and you're
Thank
on
you,
your
Mr.
way.
Chair and committee.
Next on the agenda, we have our venerable Vice Chair, Representative Nelson, with House File 1169. Vice Chair Nelson, when you're ready, feel free to move your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair West. And I would move House File 1169 before the committee. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to hear this bill today. I believe the intent of this bill is to lay it over, and part of it is just keeping the conversation going, and also an update on where we are on the paperwork, as it's loosely called, modernization. There's not a whole lot of probably actual paperwork that is done, but it's more of an information system, and I just want to acknowledge that right to start with. You know, this bill has been a process over the last, really since I was elected here in 2019. I know it was something that I inherited from somebody else. And we've been kind of working on this, trying to get different funding and studies and things like that. And over the last couple of years, there's been a study that was done. And then last biennium, we also had some funding that really started paving the way towards updating the system, which of a much needed system. There was some great testimony last year from the department, you know, showing that what has happened is a lot of needed information that's put in there, but it was described of as a snowball rolling down a hill that continues to grow, and sometimes it starts picking up sticks and logs and everything else along the way while it's kind of become a behemoth. And you know, it's kind of built on an old platform that really needs to be updated, and so we've got some just a little bit of updating that needed to be done. You know, some of the challenges we've heard from you know, when I've talked to our counties, the caseworkers, you know, they've been spending you know, some of them up to 80% of the time working on the system data entry, and the challenges and the frustration of the system crashing or just getting overloaded with work, and you know, somewhere around 20% of their time working with the individuals and families that really need their services. And ideally, we could probably have that flip-flopped. 80% of their time are with the families, really providing the needs, you know, helping get the needs and the stabilization that they need in their lives. And so with that, I really want to, I think we've got some testimony to be heard, and I would welcome that at this time.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
That is the noisiest chair for the record.
That's unfair. Good afternoon, Chair West. My name is, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Broskoff, and I'm the Director of Human Services for Brown County. And I'm here today as a Children's Committee Chair, representing the Minnesota Association of Social Service Administrators, known as MACSA. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1169. I've worked in the area of child welfare for over 20 years across a couple of counties in southern Minnesota. Over this time, I have certainly witnessed the proverbial policy pendulum swing. The child welfare system, as you've heard, is very complex, and everyone wants to ensure that no child or family experiences harm. When policymakers, generally driven by really good intentions, respond to an unfortunate child welfare incident by mandating additional paperwork, the outcome can often backfire. Instead of enhancing the welfare system, these measures overwhelm staff with administrative tasks, diverting their time and energy away from engaging and supporting families. Pieces of paper and clicks in SSIS don't keep kids safe. but the time-intensive investments our staff spend with families and children is the not-so-secret sauce of better outcomes. So as you hopefully have all heard, we've not seen significant investments in our technology system. So additional administrative work is often made more difficult by incredibly outdated computer systems. An example of this is the new requirement for staff to provide a notice of Social Security benefits. Not something I would disagree with. However, currently there is no template in SSIS, but rather each individual county must maintain their own form on a separate system. They're required to send out at least 5, but sometimes up to 10 separate certified letters containing this notice. Additionally, staff must put reminders in their own work calendars when children on their caseload turn 13 so that they can be reminded as to when to send these notices out in a timely fashion. Outside of a case note in SSIS that we've done this work, all of these other things are mentioned and are mandated are done in other computer systems that the county has to preserve and pay for. We are thankful for the increased attention that the legislature has paid to the outdated SSIS. You're listening and you're taking notice. We appreciate Representative Nelson for his continued leadership and advocacy in this area. The passage of the original Paperwork Reduction Act that passed 2 years ago resulted in DCYF staff, in collaboration with county staff, identified 56 recommendations for changes, for which 9 enhancements have been completed, and 5, as I understand, are projects in the queue. The remainder, however, are on hold due to minute resources and the limitations of SSIS. MAXA supports House File 1169 and encourages policymakers to ensure that the requirements of the technology updates have clear pathways, transparent timelines, and decision points and processes that are collaborative and co-governed with agencies to ensure timely and agile development of solutions. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today and for your continued interest in this area, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brasco. Yeah, that'll be a challenge for our committee that both Chair Katisa Watun and I are dedicated to, is how can we scrounge up money to actually make this happen, because it's been a problem. We do have one more on the list. Ms. Schapolsky. We'll see how close that was.
It's noisy too. It's just
Representative, having some Jaeger, could you pass the high chews?
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Chair Katisa Watun.
That Representative Hicks just pointed out that we don't have any silly rules about not having snacks in committee, because one of the first bipartisan decisions that Chair West and I made as co-chairs was that we both like snacks and treats.
She's not lying. That was one of the first items on our agenda when we met.
Something's showing on this screen.
Clarifying, you know, what snacks we should always have available to the committee and making sure everybody shares their favorite candies.
Charcuterie. I don't know. I mean, they all have a physical paper copy.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. We don't have this.
Okay. So one thing the committee needs to consider is, yes, it's going to be hard to find money for SSIS. It is going to be hard. But the return on that investment in lower costs, time savings for people, is going to be serious. So if we have to, I'm willing to be aggressive about where we find that money, because we could see a higher return than a lot of other areas we put it. So, okay. Then now are we good to go?
Chair West, we're having some technical difficulties, but in your packets there is the paper copy of the slides that we'll be going through.
This is also posted online if anybody would like to follow along there, since it's not on the TVs here. Ms. Schapolsky, please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair West. Good afternoon, and thank you, committee members as well. My name is Cynthia Schapolsky, and
Ms. Schapolsky,
I'm the CWIS Modernization Supervisor.
If you could pull the microphone a little closer to your mouth.
All right. How about that? All right. My name is Cynthia Schapolsky, and I'm the CWIS Modernization Supervisor at SSIS at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. I've been in child welfare for the past 25 years as a direct practice child welfare professional and at the state for the past 12 years. Today I'm going to be providing an update on the Child Protection Paperwork Reduction Act activities of SSIS. SSIS is the information system used at counties and at three American Indian Child Welfare Initiative tribal nations for social services very broadly. This was developed 30 years ago specifically to meet child welfare requirements, including federal reporting requirements. The case management system is used to document a lot of things. 76,000 reports of alleged child abuse or neglect every year, 32,000 annual child protection assessments, and child protection case management services for approximately 4,500 families every year. Excessive time spent on data entry and documentation in SSIS and other systems compromises the amount of time the caseworkers can spend with families and children in the field, which has serious impacts on the outcomes of families that we're serving. For the approximate 4,400 children who experience an out-of-home placement annually, the data entry requirements are immense. Improvements in user interface design and bidirectional data exchanges with CORD and education in modernization of SSIS will create efficiencies and feel much less burdensome on caseworkers, allowing for more direct work with children and families. As Chair West said, maybe we need to have that 80-20 flipped around. Over the past 25 years, through new laws and policy changes, this documentation has increased. Additionally, performance and stability technical issues with SSIS have also increased, leading to a more and more frustrated workforce throughout Minnesota. New technologies with responsive and intuitive designs have progressed by leaps and bounds, and keeping up with those technologies has been a real challenge as we continue to add more and more to the current system. In 2023, the Commissioner of Human Services was directed to study and make recommendations for paperwork reduction for child protection, specifically documentation in SSIS. The SSIS section at the Department of Human Services completed a child protection review from January through April of 2024. We conducted 12 formal listening sessions with input from 150 caseworkers and 50 policy staff throughout DHS. These included full walkthroughs of the required screens for all related child protection work from intake through the case closure. Additionally, SSIS staff reviewed each and every one of these screens field by field and documented and determined under what authority each and every field was or was not required. We discovered that nearly all of the child protection fields or documents within SSIS have some requirement, federal, state, or administrative. We've continued this review work on other data entry requirements, including fiscal child welfare work, such as Title IV-E for prevention and foster care services. Themes from this review could be summed up with the word frustration. Frustration with technical connections and performance, with interface usability, lack of autosave throughout the application, usability of documents, including the out-of-home placement plan, lack of accessibility, and confusion if the system is built to serve caseworkers or to serve administrative purposes. Resulting from the child protection review, we had 56 recommendations, 16 we've determined were feasible to pursue before modernization, 9 that we've completed, and 5 that we're actively working on. One item that I'd like to highlight is the out-of-home placement plan. This is a document in SSIS, and there has been much discussion around the out-of-home placement plan over the past several years. At this time, it's not feasible to overhaul the documentation module within SSIS. But we're committed to offering relief to caseworkers. We will be releasing an interim solution in April, a complimentary, secure, web-based tool that has reduced in half the out-of-home placement plan, has completely reorganized this plan in response to broad feedback in partnership with the foster care unit and staff at, in child safety and permanency at DCYF. Additionally, this interim solution for the out-of-home placement plan will be able to produce a printable one-page summary, which also has been a topic of much interest over the past several years. We look forward to continuing to partner broadly as we modernize. Thank you.
Vice Chair Nelson.
Well, thank you, Chair West, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill today. And you know, as we've heard, it's been a work in progress. It's there's been quite a lot of things that have happened, some steps that have taken and necessary, and identifying areas that have needed updating. And you know, it's in the process of it. And I think one of the things now is really going to be looking at the funding of it, of really the final piece of it, to really make to come to the end, come to the conclusion of finishing this. And so I don't know if there's any questions. I would be happy to answer them, or to I think my testifiers would be happy as well. But I'm thankful for all of those that have worked on this through the years. Representative Hansen, you were very key in getting the study done a couple of years ago, and just all of this has been important on updating and modernizing it. There's a lot of things that were really cool in 1999, and this program probably was then too, but we need to move on past that. So I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill in for all in, at this committee that have been focused on this program. This system was around when I was in St. Louis County 30 years ago or whatever it was. And so I think the fundamental thing of having the data be, user friendly for the volume of reports that we're doing today and all the policies that we set down here as far as new mandates, that just gets pushed to the counties. And the documentation system, if you've ever seen this and spent time, it would just shock you to see how archaic it is and how difficult it is to move data. And when you think of 87 counties in Minnesota and people move, to make sure children are safe and protected when you're dealing with serious situations, to make sure that data's flowing between, people are moving all the time and situations are changing. To know where that child is and for the new county to have all the current data and this copy paste and all of it, it's just really concerns me the potential of just data being lost and kids falling through the cracks. And so this just has to be a priority for Minnesota. I was shocked when I learned of it when I came here 2 years ago that this is the same system that I saw so many decades ago with the magnitude of what we're doing and the divisions are doing it at the state. So anyway, I applaud your efforts and thank you.
Do you have any response to that, Vice Chair?
I don't.
Thank you. We will go to Vice Chair Hansen and then Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair. And I want to tell this committee, I'm so proud of you for learning so much about SSIS. It has been a long journey to get folks to understand the breadth of this. And so thank you, Vice Chair Nelson, for always working together to get this done. And thank you, Chair West, for your commitment to finding funding for this. I think when we can make improvements on this, I will not get on a soapbox again, I promise, but when we can make improvements about this, it really does make it easier for the child protection workers and the social workers that are doing this. And all those kind of government efficiencies matter a whole lot in the types and quality of service we can deliver to Minnesotans when they really need it the most, and especially our littlest Minnesotans who need us. So that's all I'll say for now, but thank you so much for doing this. And again, hats off to our committee for really diving into this, because it's complicated, and I'm glad to see this moving ahead. Thanks.
We do indeed have the best committee. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. You know, no one cares about SSIS. It doesn't seem like, so I'm glad that we're doing it. I do have a question.
Sorry, I didn't turn that on. I'm very familiar with SSIS. I'm less familiar with how SSIS interacts with MAXIS, with how it interacts with MMIS, and I don't mean to make this more complicated, but using child protection as the, how will this bill, the Paperwork Reduction Act, let's put money into SSIS for sure. Let's do it. It's the least sexy money we spend, and I think it's why we haven't done anything. And how will this bill also kind of create those reduce those redundancies between MMIS, MAXIS, and I don't even know how they interact. I'm guessing that kids in child protection are also in MMIS, and there's a lot of redundancies that are out there. Can you talk a little bit about how this will impact that as well?
Ms. Polsky.
Thank you for the question. What I can say is that, yes, you are correct that we do have data exchanges in SSIS with all of these other systems that you have mentioned. And as part of our modernization efforts, where the federal government is really encouraging us, and that includes through some financial encouragement, to improve all of those data interchanges. So I mentioned with various education systems, with court systems, which would reduce duplicative entry for all of those parties. Additionally, we do have dependencies on these other systems. As you know, we families are not, they don't live in silos, and we are not going to approach the work in silos. We want to treat families the whole family. And that includes in how we're working to have secure data exchanges with all of those other systems. So while I don't believe that there's anything specifically related to those other systems in this bill, that is part of SSIS's goals in modernization to improve those data exchanges with the other state systems.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you.
If that's our commitment, and we know that this committee right here is in full support, well, theoretically full support of Representative Nelson's approach, I mean, is the department, this is not a new problem. This has been going on a long time. And I want to make sure that the department is also committed to this. The number of people that work in these systems is incredible, from case managers to social workers to the people that get into these systems to pay the invoices. I mean, there's lots of people. And I just want to make sure that there's a real commitment from the department to, put this high on the list. I mean, we can only do so much, and I get it. Our job is to find the money, and we want to do that. But it's going to be a lot easier if the department is committed to making those upgrades as well. And I'm not trying to be mean or put anybody on the spot, but this is not a new problem. So can you just tell me that we're all in this together?
We're all in this together.
Excellent work. Any more member discussion? And I did not ask for public testimony, so I'll do that now. Is there any member of the public here today who would like to speak on this matter? Seeing none, I'll officially close public testimony, and I will close member discussion unless, Chair Katizawa, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nadeau, that was actually going to be one of my questions. I didn't quite get the amount of clarity that I need personally on how the systems kind of stack. So potentially we can go offline about this, but I do think it would be helpful for the whole committee to kind of understand if like SSIS is a portion of the system down here and what is layered above it, or like how it all kind of connects. Because I did note in the presentation, currently there's a web-based system that social workers to be able to access through Minute, but looking at what we need to do to kind of impact the SSIS section of things and then expand that on the whole over coming years. And I know that Chair West and I are very aligned, knowing that finances are what they are, and you know, maybe we'll be surprised with the February forecast when it comes out in March. but I am curious, just kind of how that looks and everything. So I think a number of us have the opportunity, or have had the opportunity, to meet directly with our counties or other counties in the surrounding area, and I think that that is really helpful, just for us to understand how it works in practice, and how the funding of that. One question I guess I did have about this, and I'm a co-author of the bill, and have been lucky to work with Vice Chair Hansen, and she shares her expertise, and then I know Vice Chair Nelson has really kind of taken this on and wants to move forward. What Vice Chair Nelson, what differences in this proposal go above and beyond kind of what the study did in 2023, or is this trying to get at more of the fiscal impact? Just kind of looking at next steps.
Vice Chair Nelson.
So the bill, you know, kind of the bumpy start we had this session. I just kind of copied and pasted I just had it rejacketed from a prior session. So it really probably is not drafted in the way it really should be. My intent with the bill is that we would take the information that has been in the studies, and that is really, that's already starting, as we've heard from the testimony, and that what we'd really be focusing on here is really finding the financial piece of that to really finish that out. And I understand that there's a couple of, I don't know if lack of better words, bids that will be coming in from some vendors that we'll be potentially working with. And so we're kind of waiting on that design build piece of that to know where the what the true cost is. There's about 50% of this that will be able to be covered with a federal match. So that's an important part of this, is to be able to, a lot of these regulations that we're following here are federal. And so some of these are covered by federal. So I think that's an important part of it, that it's thankfully not all coming out of our budget, but we do need to, we need to be able to spearhead this and be able to give the direction on it to be able to get those funding.
Chair Katisa Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that response, Vice Chair Nelson. I appreciate just kind of knowing what is next in the process in your mind. And I appreciate also that you flagged that there is a federal match at this point in time. So much of the work that we do in this committee is funded by the federal government. And so I think that given some of the conversations that are happening with DOGE out in Washington, D.C. right now, I mean, there was multiple programs that were frozen, including SNAP, including the North Star Assistance Program Representative Hicks is going to talk about next, all these sorts of things, and how they so intimately intertwine with the work and the funding that we put in place here in Minnesota. So I think that it's really of interest to this committee and to the entire legislature, that we keep a very close eye on those cuts and make sure that the money that we're spending that does incredibly important work continues to come in, so that our entire state budget isn't blown up by the feds.
Vice Chair Nelson, would you like to close out your bill?
I thank you. Thank you, Chair West and committee, for hearing this bill today. And, as I learned about the SSIS system, the Social Services Information System, it became a lot. When I was, I first heard about it, I'm like, okay, it's a simple bill. We need to reduce paperwork. And I was grossly underestimating how little I knew of this system. This touches everyone's lives. Basically from prenatal till really to the grave. If any individual has any contact with your county social services, you are in the system. And I think our focus has been on really probably the biggest chunk of it is, you know, is with children. That is some of the biggest load. So that's kind of been our focus. But I mean, our hope is that all of this will be addressed and will be really updated and modernized. Whether, you know, and I'm not sure what the answer is to the Maxis system. I'm hoping that the interfaces will all continue to work well. And I think there's probably a need for some updating there as well. But I think, you know, for right now, we're working on this area. And I just appreciate the work of the committee and the indulgence. You know, it's not this cool, flashy new thing. And so when people ask me what I'm working on, it's a little bit nerdy to be able to say what I'm doing, but it's something that's desperately needed, and I think will desperately help our caseworkers and especially the families that we're intending to help in our communities. So thank you with that. And with that, do I need to make the motion or?
You can renew your motion, Alito.
I would renew my motion to lay the bill over.
And House File?
1169.
1169 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Last but not least, Representative Hicks and House File 1276. Now, Representative Hicks brought this bill up to me in the retiring room a couple days ago, and we had a brief discussion on it, and, well, we all dream of having lots of money, but outside of that, it seems like a very good bill to me. So I would be on it, but I have a rule about I don't want to put my name on anything that costs money outside of early learning scholarships, because I know there will be a lot of unpleasant conversations about who didn't get what when the time comes. But it'll all be my co-chair's fault. I will let them know. All right. Representative Hicks, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move my bill for possible inclusion. First of all, I want to say thank you for agreeing to hear this after our brief retiring room conversation. there's a lot of folks who are new on the committee, so if you'll give me just a little bit of grace, I'd like to do a little bit of background. The North Star Care for Children is a financial benefit for children who are placed in foster care and whose custody has been transferred or adopted to a relative or a kin. North Star Kinship Assistance and North Star Adoption Assistance improve permanency for children by increasing the number of children who transition from foster care to a permanent family. North Star Care for Children payments differ depending on the child's age and level of need. Children who reach permanency while under the age of 6 receive the preschool entry alternative rate, which is approximately half the financial benefits of children over the age of 6. This bill eliminates that alternative rate for children who reach permanency with relatives or within individuals who are identified in MIFPA. The reason for this is to support family members to be able to get to yes. This really supports children and kinship families. It helps create long-term stability, keeps families together, and helps siblings stay together. Many times, family members are not planning on starting over or raising their grandchildren. This helps them be able to get to yes. They so desperately want to say yes. There was a study that was released last year about North Star's benefits for children 6 and older, which showed that permanency with North Star benefits raised academic achievement by about 31%, and over the outcomes were astronomical across the spectrum. Include things like improved school stability and reduced school suspensions and behavioral concerns. This change in this bill would give us a chance to really help those families bringing in kin under 6. Currently, county agencies may request to delay finalizing permanency. They wait until a child turns 6 so that the family can receive the full funds. This means children are waiting. We hear all the time from families that the reason they can't say yes is that they're not able to provide for the child. Grandparents who are in their late 50s, early 60s, and weren't planning to start over, don't have $20,000 to pay a year to pay for childcare, as we've talked about in this space. They want to say yes. This gives them an easier way to get there. In many cases, our child placing agencies, our counties, are faced with two choices. Move the child from family, which is not in their best interest and not what their family wants. Or wait for permanency and keep them in foster care until they're six. This bill works to try to fix that for so many kiddos and families. In your packets, you will find a bit of a stack of support letters and reports. There are a couple more coming to you that I didn't get in time, so I am really sorry about that. You'll see letters from individuals. You'll see letters from agencies. You'll see letters from counties. You'll see letters across the board. There's also a report, if you are interested in some reading in this space that I chatted about today, that I find fascinating. And I would encourage any of you where this is an area of interest to take the time to read it. I do have some testifiers with me today who can speak much more eloquently than I can about this topic. So I would invite them to come up.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Sadie Hart, and I'm the Policy and Advocacy Director at the Ainda Young Center in St. Paul. Ainda Young means our home in Ojibwe, and we provide a healing place within the community for American Indian youth and families to thrive in safety and wholeness. I'm also a co-chair of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors Family Preservation Committee, which is where this version of the bill is coming from. So I monitor child welfare proceedings and work with justice partners in the metro to comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act and Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. In one of the current cases that I monitor, an uncle is providing foster care for two siblings, one's 13 and one's 4, and he wasn't sure if he would be able to financially care for both of them, with the younger child receiving the reduced rate once she reaches permanency. So his two choices were, or the county's two choices, were to risk that placement disrupting and having that child most likely go to a non-relative placement, or separating the siblings, even though that relative could provide a loving and stable home with the proper financial support. So the decision that they did was to keep the child in foster care until she turns six and can receive the full benefits. And the concern that we have with that option is that it's taking away direct services and resources that could be better utilized by other families in the system. With the last bill, you heard how much time is taken by documentation, and that's also a concern of ours, is that it's taking resources from families, it's taking up judicial resources, guardians ad litem, tribal attorneys, social workers, anyone involved in the court system, it's taking up additional time and resources. Sibling separation is a very big issue in foster care. In 2023, there were 490 children waiting for adoption. 45% were siblings who needed to be adopted together, and 20% were children under the age of six. I want to reiterate a couple of the points that Representative Hicks made from the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research study. The full payments raised average academic achievement by about 31% based on outcomes recorded 3 years after foster care episode started. They raised the chance of moving from foster care to adoption or kin guardianship by 29% and on average decreased time to permanency by approximately 5 months. So these are just a few examples of how the bill could impact fosters, their families, and the child welfare system. Thank you for letting us have this hearing and considering this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Hart. Next on the list, Brittany Lamb.
Yes. Yes. Oh. Hi. Thank
you. Ms. Lamb, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Chair West and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Brittany Lamb. I've been a social worker in foster care and adoption in Minnesota for nearly 9 years. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in support of HF 1276. While my employer also submitted a letter of support that you'll find in your packet, I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Social Service Association, a network of over 5,000 health and human service professionals across the state. Many of us work in child welfare, and we are all committed to making sure every child grows up in a loving and stable home. This bill is about keeping our promise to children in foster care who we said we'd take care of. If passed, it will ensure that the youngest children in foster care receive the support they need to thrive after they find permanent homes. As Representative Hicks described, children under six currently receive half of the financial benefits that they do while in foster care. This current system doesn't make any sense. The cost of raising a child isn't halved just because they're younger when they achieve permanency. In fact, children often need more resources, support, and care in the early development years. Costs add up for things like childcare and services to help children heal from the adversity they've experienced. Childcare can be especially financially challenging because many children have complex needs that require more specialized and therefore more expensive forms of childcare. I've heard from many caregivers who may not have planned to raise a child, but they want to provide a safe and stable home for their young relatives. They want to keep siblings together and keep children out of non-relative homes, but they find themselves facing financial hardship to do so. Amidst all that goes into getting licensed and caring for children who have experienced trauma, some caregivers don't realize that their child's benefits will be reduced by half or even more after finalization. They're caught off guard and suddenly lacking the support they had planned for. One caregiver told me, they said I would get financial help. I wouldn't have adopted this child if I had known it was going to be less. I love them and want to help, but I just can't afford their care. No one wants to say or hear that, but it's the reality that many families face, and we need to acknowledge that. Without proper financial support, some families may be forced to see children re-enter the foster care system. As Representative Hicks described, sometimes finalization is delayed until a child turns six to ensure they receive full benefits. But as others have attested today, this keeps kids in foster care longer and disrupts stability and adds to already full caseloads and more burden on the system. Again, this bill is a way to uphold our promise to take care of kids in foster care. By ensuring equal financial support, regardless of the age the child achieves permanency, we can help more children find stable, loving homes without making it harder for their loved ones who step up to care for them. I urge you to support HF 1276 and help Minnesota children get the care they deserve. Thank you for your time and commitment to the kids and families of the state, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Lamb. Next on the list, we have Laura Newton. Thank you for coming before the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Laura Newton, and I am the Family Services Program Director, testifying today from the Minneapolis American Indian Center. I'm also the chair of the Metro Urban Indian Directors Family Preservation Committee, who assisted in bringing this bill forward today. I'm testifying today in support of House File 1276. I've been working with my relatives in the Native American community for over 20 years. I've had the unique ability to see how things have worked prior to the North Star legislation being enacted and what has kind of happened since. I have firsthand experience supporting our tribal liaisons at the Minneapolis American Indian Center who serve our out-of-state tribes and provide recommendations in child protection court proceedings. I've also served as a tribal liaison myself and made recommendations for tribes on behalf of their members. The Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act outline that children who are placed out of home should first be placed with relatives, which is why this bill is so important to us. In In the past several years, I've noticed a pattern has emerged with our relatives that are caring for children ages 0 to 5. Currently, North Star Care for Children payments differ depending on ages of children under 6, in that they receive the preschool entry alternate rate, which is approximately half the financial rate that children over 6 receive and their relatives would receive. This places an undue hardship on children and their relatives when they're asked to provide permanent care for them. It also means that counties and courts often delay cases until children turn age 6. This is detrimental to our kids. They need to be able to understand and know where they're going to be permanently. And when things are delayed, it really causes a strain on the system in which all the parties are having to do continued work when those resources could be going to cases that have more imminent need, especially in the cases that other folks had described today. I've seen relatives struggle to proceed forward with taking custody of a child because of the concerns that they have regarding whether or not there be financial need to adequately support them. Many of the children that we work with have specialized medical needs or other special care that they need. And so it's very difficult to go forward knowing that they might not have the resources that they need in the future. I implore you to support this bill and to help us remedy this discrepancy, and to provide support for our relatives who are adopting or taking custody of their relative children. Thank you for allowing me to present today, and thank you, committee.
Thank you, Ms. Newton. Next on the list, we have Michaela Maxwell. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
My name is Michaela Maxwell, and I am in support of the HS 1276 bill. And I was a foster caregiver, but I am also part of ICWA. Oops, sorry. I'm from the Ihangtumano Yate and the Red Lake Ojibwe, and Kewame from Pueblo. And in our cultures, it's important to be caregivers to all of our family members and our extended family. It's very vital. I was raised in those traditions and morals, and because of that, I became a foster caregiver to my niece and nephew. My youngest, he is of the preschool age, and what really impacted my role in my decision with his permanency is he is such a great kid. He is super bright and super loving, and him and his sister have been through so much, and I really appreciate their perseverance, and they have taught me a lot. But also, I know that they need a lot of support and services, and I knew that going in for being a potential permanent option for them, that I would potentially have the funding cut for the youngest. He entered care age three going on 4, and I had to figure out how could I best support him and his needs. He has significant needs, and I knew already, he was already, you know, let go from 2 daycares, that I would have to, might have similar issues down the line with him and then with her, since she did not start school. I knew they both need significant supports and services. That could I do it as a single parent, you know? And I really sat back, and I really appreciated the team that I worked with, and they, you know, supported them staying with me. And we finalized last month. Thank you. I am their permanent guardian now, and I know, and I'm very appreciative of them waiting until my youngest boy turned 6. And now I don't have those worries anymore about him. What am I going to do with his funding cut in half? Like, I need a plan B, C, D, E, and F for both of them, and whatever their mental, emotional, and spiritual and physical needs are down the line. And that's why I think it's very important to support HS 1276.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on the list, and if you're here to testify and you're not on the list, feel free to step up after this testimony, is Nina Vongfeth. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nina Vongpeth. I am currently the American Indian Liaison at Hennepin County. Chair West, you did pronounce my last name right, so thank you. So thank you, Chair West and members of the committee. I am a formal social worker supporting families here in Minnesota. I'm here today to express my strong support for HF 1276, which aims to provide essential financial assistance to kinship caregivers, relatives who step in to care for children when their parents are unable to do so. In my experience as a social worker, I witnessed numerous instances, along with my colleagues, where grandparents, aunts, uncles, and even older siblings open their homes to care for their young relatives. Their commitment to keeping children within the family unit is commendable and aligns with the best interests of the child. However, many of these caregivers face significant financial challenges as they often live on fixed incomes or have not planned for the sudden addition of children to their households. Families we have worked with may struggle to provide basic necessities and additional needs for children when they want to provide for them. Without adequate financial support, there is heartbreaking possibility of placing the children into the foster care system solely due to economic constraints. The lack of financial resources for kinship caregivers often results in children remaining in the child protective system longer than necessary. This not only places additional strain on the foster care system, but also disrupts the child's sense of stability and belonging. Prolonged stays in the system can lead to emotional and psychological challenges for children, including attachment issues and academic difficulties. Moreover, the financial strain on caregivers can lead to inadequate access to medical care, educational resources, and other essential services for the children. The situation exacerbates the trauma experienced by these young individuals and hinders their development and well-being. The North Star Care for Children program was a significant step toward addressing these issues by unifying benefits for foster care, adoption assistance, and kinship assistance. However, gaps remain, particularly for those caregivers who step forward informally without going through the foster care system. These families often do not receive the support they desperately need. We can extend financial assistance to all kinship caregivers, ensuring that children can remain with their families in a stable and nurturing environment. This support will not only elevate the economic burdens faced by caregivers, but also promote better outcomes for the children involved. So I urge the committee to support HF 1276, providing financial assistance to kinship caregivers in a compassionate and necessary step to strengthen our families and communities, ensuring that every child has the opportunity to thrive within a loving family setting. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on House File 1276? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And again, members, you have many, 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 many letters in your packet for further testimony that you can read. Do we have any member discussion? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks, thanks for the bill. You live and breathe this, and you do God's work, if you ask me, so thank you. Question for Mr. Berg, our fiscal analyst. Just wonder what the numbers are. You know, I've been looking up some research on the North Star Act and trying to find some numbers. So under sections 1.16 to 1.9, a full amount, I certainly think I can agree with that. If you get half at one point, now that you adopt and it's permanency, you should receive probably or could receive the full amount. Just what numbers are we talking about that are applicable for this program?
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, if you're asking about how much are we spending now on the overall program, the base for 26-27 is about $220-some million. There is a pending fiscal note on this bill because equalizing the rate upward will cost money, and that fiscal note is not done yet, so I can't tell you the cost of this bill yet. So is that get at your question.
Representative McDonald.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Berg. No, actually, I wasn't going to ask that question. I wanted to bring it down to a more family level, and how much more would the family receive once the permanency? Maybe it's the author, Representative Hicks, could answer that as well.
Yes. So,
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. So there's not a one set. It's based on the child's age and the child's needs, as I stated. And so a child with more significant challenges may have a different rate. The other thing that I think is important to talk about is that if they're in, if they're in foster care and then they move to permanency, the rate is cut in half. So they are getting more, and then it goes to less. Birth to five, the daily rate is about $25 a day, and the alternative daily rate is about $12. And so those two numbers are important because there's a whole process. We go through something called the MAPSE, and the MAPSE is an in-depth interview with the child and the permanency placement, the family, and then the worker, and the MAPSE assessor is not the same person. So there's three people that do the assessment, and they determine the rate, you know, in that range based on a variety of things that are part of that conversation. Does the child have an IEP? Does the child have physical needs? Does the child have mental health needs? Does the child have a learning disability? Do they have a developmental condition? Do they have diabetes? Or do they have a complex medical condition? Do they have a G-tube? Do they have a trach? Do they, like, all of those things go into that conversation. So I could give you numbers, but it's really very specific to the child. And I think the important thing to remember is that it gets cut in half if you say yes.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Hicks. Yes, say yes to the bill and say yes for people to be the permanency. And I did research that. I see that each county is different as well. There's a rate for Hennepin County and Anoka County, and those are adjustable, I see. Is that correct?
Representative Hicks.
I'm actually not 100% sure on the details. I know the MAPSE determines everything. So the MAPSE is what determines it. And the MAPSE is done in every county, in every child. And there are different factors that go into that conversation, and perhaps location is a part of that. It probably is related to child care costs. But the MAPSE is a complicated tool. If you would like to sit down and go through a MAPSE, I would love to do that with you. In fact, I would love to do it with the whole committee. So, chairs, that's an idea I would love to throw out. I would love to sit down and go through the MAPSE with people. I really do think that understand that the weeds of foster care would be really beneficial for all of us to do. So this is my offer to do that with any of you at any time.
That I did spawn a question myself for Mr. Berg on the $220 million, or if we were to invest more into this particular bill, is there a portion the federal government picks up in any way in this bill or in general in the program?
Mr. Chairman, the $220 I mentioned was strictly state costs on that, and I do not know off the top of my head if there's other federal reimbursement on this or not. I'd have to check on that. I don't think there is. I think this is a state program, but I don't quote me on that. I will respond to you on an email to confirm that.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks, for bringing this forward. I want to thank the testifiers of our tribal nations. As a Boricua, which most folks think, what is a Boricua, but as First Nations of Puerto Rico, it's the colonized name, we talk about the connections of village from my tribal nation to here on Turtle Island. And we talk about investing in our children, specifically our tribal children, to connect and stay with their family members through a process that you know firsthand is difficult, but in particularly to the first families of this nation, this is restorative justice. These are avenues of restorative justice. When we talk about children being able to stay in their village and connect with their traditions, connect with their family members or folks that may not be blood, but are part of that village, you can't place a dollar sign onto that. And I understand we're here talking about fiscal notes and numbers, but we're talking about healing, and we're talking about being a better Minnesota. And what better way to do that when we can keep our littlest Minnesotans with their families and make sure that the families have those needs to ensure that that kid grows up to be an adult and an adult in their land of seven generations to continue to build this great state. So I just want to give praises to that and highlight to my colleagues on both sides of the aisle for bringing this forward, because these are the pieces that connect the good work that we do together to talk about what restorative justice is. That's all.
Representative Hicks, any comments?
No, thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
you started my question to Mr. Berg, and I just want to follow up to make sure I understand. So, first, Mr. Berg, is there no federal dollars that are being contributed to this program?
The grilling of Mr. Berg continues.
Mr. Chair, I was just looking in the budget book. There is, and it was mentioned before, there's Title IV-E money that does come for permanency, foster care, kinship assistance. I cannot tell you right now exactly what we do with the Title IV-E money. I do not know that it goes directly into the rate to parents or to family. I'll have to check on that. And overall, in this area of the budget, there is about $9.5 million a year in federal money out of, as I say, the North Star program. The base is between 220 and 230 million for the next biennium. So the federal money is not a substantial part of the money.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. And just a final follow-up from Mr. Berg, and then I have one more question. So is that inclusive of ICWA money, or is that a different funding source completely?
I'd need to check more on it, but ICWA is separate from the rest of the system. There is, I mean, that under federal law, ICWA cases are very much separated from the rest of the child permanency system.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. Do you know why the current statutes have that financial rate cut in half for the youngest kids? Do you know why that was originally put in place?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. I can ask the department to come up. I'll tell you my opinion. Do you want my opinion? It is not factual. It might be. I'm not sure. We'll see what Jennifer says. But I think the truth of the matter is it's a lot easier to place young kids. It's really, really hard to place older kids. That's been my experience. But I'll let Jennifer talk about what the actual history is. I'm telling you my lived experience. It's much, much harder.
Ms. Mr. Chair. Sunfield, please introduce yourself for the record and share your wisdom.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. I was not working for the department at the time that North Star was put into place, but I was working with people who were working directly on that bill. My understanding and recollection is that the reason North Star was put in place with the preschool entry rate was really a fiscal issue. There just wasn't enough money to go around to cover all of the cases that were there, and so a decision was made that it was easier for children under six to achieve permanency, and so that's where the cutoff was made in order to try to save dollars rather than fully fund North Star for everybody.
Representative Nadeau.
And my final question is starting down on line 1.21, where we talk about state share. And I might be reading this incorrectly, and so just correct me if I am. It looks to me like the bill has to do with the North Star Kinship Program, but it looks like there's three different funding sources. There's the foster care program under 260C, and then the custody assistance program under 142A, and then the North Star Care for Children Adoption Assistance Program under 259A. And I'm wondering if this bill, sorry, the agency was still up there. My apologies.
Jennifer can come back.
I'm wondering if your bill, it looks like this bill only deals with the preschool entry into kinship assistance program, but are there other funding programs that we're overlooking? If we looked at, I mean, I think everyone here would support this, you know, depending on if there's enough money to cover it. And so are there other financial considerations that need to be taken into account as well?
So I actually do know the
Representative
answer.
Representative Hicks?
I actually do know the answer. So I'm very proud of myself because this is incredibly complicated. But Jennifer's going to stay here in case I get it wrong. So 1.3 is the legacy custodial supports that has been phased out because of North Star. So that's like not here anymore, right? That's the legacy custody?
That's the legacy program, yes. And I am not able to speak to whether it's fully phased out right now or not. I'd have to check on that.
Are we close?
It's close, but not quite phased out yet.
So what that means when we say that close, that means that, oh, I'm sorry. When we say it's close, that means that those kids are already in high school because we transitioned to North Star. So that piece is referenced here. The other piece is that, as you have all figured out, this is incredibly complicated for a fiscal. It's really complicated for a few reasons. One, because there's all the different funding streams. We have all of those different pieces involved in it. The other piece that's a little bit complicated, as you heard from my testifiers, is when we try to capture the fiscal, we already have families that are waiting till six to achieve permanency. And so when we talk about the fiscal, we talk about, well, it's going to cost X, and we don't know what that is yet, but it's going to cost X. But it's hard to account for a negative, so it's hard to account for what we're already spending because they're waiting till they're six. And to be clear, they're getting the full amount as long as they remain in foster care. It's once they achieve permanency under six that it gets cut in half. So our expenses from birth to six, if they never leave foster care, are set, are stagnant. They're at the moment. If they get adopted at five, we cut that in half for folks. So people just wait until they're six. And so when we try to capture the fiscal, this is where it gets a little sticky, because how do you know how many people are waiting? We know anecdotally from my testifiers today and from the packets and the things you've seen and what we hear from our counties, we know anecdotally that that's happening. But how do we capture that in a fiscal is a question that I think Mr. Berg is going to have a wonderful time practicing.
Thank you.
Well, Representative, no.
Okay. You know, and thank you. And it is, I mean, it is complex, and I appreciate that. And I'm new to this committee, and I appreciate you, you know, trying to explain that. So we don't know what the fiscal, will we, how long will it, has a fiscal note been requested on this bill? Okay.
Representative,
go ahead.
Do you mind? Representative Hicks?
I just want to defend myself because I went and talked to Chair West before I dropped it, and he really liked it. So I had a very quick turnaround. I'm not intentionally trying to come without a fiscal.
No.
Yeah, that is, we've had a lot of bills without fiscal. We're just having, talking here. We'll see what the money is when the money comes. Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks.
Any further member discussion? Chair Katiza Batu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks, this is such an important bill. And as a fellow North Star Assistance family, my husband and I adopted three kids out of the foster care system when they were under the age of six. We talked a little bit about offline the difference between families who are opening their hearts and their homes to expand their family specifically through foster care and what that looks like financially often for folks versus kinship care. And we know that in the conversations that we've had in this committee about the African-American and underrepresented child permanency act that we passed in 2024, kinship is often in the best interest of the child. And so when we come to these families and we say, hey, This we know that this child being with auntie or grandma or grandpa or uncle or whomever, big brother, big sister, is going to be what's best for them. There are so many financial restrictions because they have not planned to welcome these child. They have not planned to expand their family through taking on a kin, child or children, through this process. So, I think, it's really important for us to have this conversation. And we know that, you know, to the extent that this is scalable, to the extent that we're dealing with, you know, fiscal challenges at this point in time, we still need to talk about what is happening and the impact, that the very long term and real impact that it does have on
the children and families of Minnesota. One question that does occur to me, and I'm not sure if this is something that you have thought about or if even over the history of the program that the department maybe has considered, is, you know, so many of our programs, our public programs, are based on financial need. And so I don't know if that's ever been a part of the North Star Assistance children in adoption assistance for, you know, families, if we've said, hey, do you have enough money? Do you make enough money? So if we're considering expanding this to kinship families, and there might be some of them who are in a strong fiscal situation personally, is that one way that we could potentially more specifically direct the needed funds to the families who are in most need?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Representative, and thank you for, you know, highlighting the importance of having the conversation and that it is different, right? It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the conversation. So I do really appreciate that. That isn't a something we've discussed specifically yet. I will tell you, however, that I am meeting with the department to get some further TA and have some further conversations, and so I welcome any feedback. So I just really do appreciate any ideas that anyone has as well.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. For those of you who don't know, Representative Hicks and I work a lot on the child protection stuff together, and so we kind of split up some of the duties here. So while we're on this topic, I just want to make a plug for a bill that we are both carrying, and she's a co-author on, as well as some other members of the committee. It's House File 1424. Obviously, increasing payments is a super important piece of this, making sure we're supporting families that way, but there's also some policy changes that we can also make. So if you're interested in this subject, a little more reading for you, check out House File 1424, and hopefully we can have some further conversations about that as well. But I just wanted to use the opportunity to plug a bill we both care about a lot while we were on the subject. So thank you, Chair.
I've never written nonpartisan on the list before, but I got to. Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I've been looking through the federal grant tables for the department while we're at it, and there is more money than I mentioned in there. There is a grant for guardianship assistance from the federal government that is $36 million a year. That is, as it is described, assistance intended to prevent inappropriately long stays in foster care and several other purposes to increase safety and permanency. And there is a small grant of $1.5 million a year that is for kinship navigators. And that is, you get into, as was mentioned before, federal Title IV-E funding. So there is more than I was thinking, but it is not like a match program like in medical assistance where they pay half the bill or something.
Gotcha. Thank you, Mr. Berg. That's very valuable. Representative Hicks, would you like to close out your wonderful bill?
Yes. Thank you so much, everyone, for the wonderful discussion, and to all my testifiers for coming and sharing their personal and professional experience today. And for all of you for being open and willing to have a difficult conversation about what is child welfare. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hicks renews her motion to have House File 1276 laid over for a possible inclusion in a very expensive omnibus bill. All right, members, that is our agenda for today. Next week we'll have some bills on Tuesday to be determined, and we will have a modernization changes discussion from the department specifically, focused on the changes, and we welcome public testimony on the modernization movement at that time. Yes. Yeah, modernization of childcare licensure. Relevant detail. And with that, we are adjourned.